listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. The political outrage continued this week after President Trump's meeting with Vladimir Putin a week ago. It now includes calls for President Trump to be removed from office on the grounds of treason, and in one case, an allegedly leftist website contained an article calling for a military coup to remove Trump and, after trial, hang him. But we open our discussion with Professor Tony Montero with reference to a much saner conversation that he had with BlackAgendaReport.com's Glenn Ford last week.
Well, you know, that interview, which I think got a lot of circulation on social media and perhaps other places because of the headline where I asserted that Trump was the most pro-peace president since John F. Kennedy.
Right.
And I conditioned it, with the observation that no American presidency in the last 70 years or a little more has been pro-peace, because each of them in one or another way has had to bow to the state and to the requirements of American hegemony, or the Pax Americana, the American empire. Yeah. But once you peel away all of the rhetoric of the mainstream media and the punditry, and even a lot of Trump's tweeting and histrionics, I think, what you see is a certain logic that goes against the direction of defending and consolidating American hegemony, even if doing it under new conditions of the rise of China and the rise of Asia and the relative decline of American power. So on the one side, you get Hillary, who wanted to make certain minor reforms while at the same time pursuing the project of war and imperialist advance. And you had Trump, who even during the campaign said the very opposite. He was calling for imperial retreat,
right,
and literally saying that we had to prepare ourselves for an era of peaceful coexistence with China and Russia and economic competition.
Right.
And whether one agrees with how he pursues the economic competition, that is through tariffs and what they're calling a trade war, is one thing. However, when he says he is in favor of doing all of this through peaceful means and detente and peaceful coexistence, that is something that we have to take seriously. And the problem is that the left, which is really, for the most part, social democratic and liberal left, with on its fringe the anarchists, Trotskyists, ultra-leftists, but all a part of a single cloth of the anti-Trump movement, wrongly called the resistance, are missing it all and do not understand the historic moment that we live in.
You know, it seems to me that no matter what the avowed political orientation of the commentator today, looking at what happens with Trump, the present company accepted, but the ideological slice or micro slice, given the way the left is so parceled up, that regardless of how they approach the problem, at the end of the day, in a world where the U.S. is at war in 7 or 8 or 10, depending on which calculus you used, different places, where millions of people are literally a meal away from dying in places like Yemen and DR Congo and elsewhere, where NATO and the U.S. allies in Asia, essentially the U.S. military, is up against the borders of Russia and China and drilling like mad for the last 4 years now. No matter what the supposed theoretical approach of the commentator is, none of them, for some reason, are able to look at Trump saying, let's back off of this and re-engage the world in a peaceful fashion instead of going to war with Russia and China. No one seems to be able to say, yes, let's declare support for that position and figure out how to actualize it. You have the President of the United States, for the first time in my lifetime, because your article says essentially Trump is the most pro-peace president we've had since JFK, and of course the JFK when he was attacking the CIA back in his day, like Trump is doing now, could have said, "Hey, I need the CIA like I need another hole in my head."
Right.
You know that no one, not one, not the PSL or International Action or any anarchist or RCP or nobody seems to be able to say we have to assume that this guy is telling the truth regardless of his intent and force his hand with our support. Nobody's saying that, which is normally how you engage in politics.
No. Well, one thing you've mentioned, the so-called revolutionary left, and I say so-called because that's yet to be shown that they're revolutionary.
Right.
But they have, for the most part, never been involved in politics in the Leninist sense of politics or the revolutionary sense of politics. They long ago abandoned any attempt at mobilizing and going among the masses to talk about what the issues are. And in the first place, I would say, and this is the segment of the population that they have written off, which is probably among the most politically mobilized and active parts of the population, it's that group of people who, irregardless of party identification, put Trump in office. And a big part of that group is the formerly industrial proletariat. And I always go back to Pennsylvania. Trump could not have won Pennsylvania, which no Republican had done in over 30 years, had those small, formerly industrial steel towns in western Pennsylvania and other manufacturing towns in central Pennsylvania, and the unemployed and poor of Philadelphia. If that group had not either voted for Trump or refused to vote at all, which meant voting for Hillary Clinton, if that had not happened, Trump could not have won Pennsylvania. To me, that is the group that the radicals and so-called revolutionaries have to focus upon, not as they are doing, the petty bourgeoisie, who are good at turning out for rallies, but cannot sustain anything, especially in the battle of ideas and the battle of political organization. I say all that to say that that group that voted Trump into office have pretty much remained consistent in their demand that, which he articulated, that we don't want war with Russia, that intervention and regime change has gotten us into a situation of endless war, and they didn't want that anymore, that they wanted some addressing of this inequality that flows out of this neoliberal globalization and the World Trade Organization and these global trade agreements and treaties like the Trans-Pacific Partnership. They wanted done with that. They wanted a renegotiation of NAFTA. I mean, they wanted jobs and peace. That's what they were saying.
That's right.
And for the so-called left, now here I'm using it in the broad sense, both the ultra-left and the social democratic and liberal left have joined hands really with the deep state in a united front against Trump and literally are calling for either his impeachment or his removal from office, as one commentator said, by any means necessary. This is an abandonment of the working class of all colors and of the poor who have nothing to do with their resistance. So I stand by what I said in the interview with Glenn Ford. Indeed, he is the most peace candidate. In fact, he might go beyond JFK. And it's in both the positive sense of negotiations and summitry with Kim Jong-un, with Vladimir Putin, and possibly in the future with Xi Jinping, but in the negative sense of opposition to the expansion of NATO, of calling into question NATO's existence. What does it exist for? And the other thing is that his example is encouraging similar movements throughout Europe. We are literally looking at a collapse of the old European order. That is, the order that emerges after World War II based upon American power and European acquiescence in and support for American power. This is now in crisis. Even Henry Kissinger admitted that Trump is one of those figures who comes along occasionally in history who represent the end of an era and the beginning, perhaps, of something new.
You know, it's, I think, timely to mention the, I guess, the fact that the post-World War II order, really, its utility has been largely spent.
Yeah.
We saw that being acknowledged in Europe 30 years ago now, with the reunification of Germany, the dissolution of the Bloc. That was the Bloc that the Soviet Union had organized in response to NATO. The rhetoric of the time, which made it appear that what was happening on the east side of the division line in Europe was also happening on the west side, that there had been an acknowledgement that Bloc politics were obsolete and that now we're all going to be pals. And so go ahead and deconstruct your defensive apparatus, and we will deconstruct our offensive apparatus. But what ended up happening was they just put the offensive apparatus on rail cars and rolled it up to Russia's border and started building it up on site.
Right.
You had, though, no similar movements in Asia, with the exception, a big exception, of the change in relations with China, which contained within it the contradictions of things like the Tiananmen Square, with an attempted color revolution in China. But now it seems that Trump's election, in the context of the rising multipolarity and on the international scene, either was in response to, in any event, is related to further maturing of the international situation, and sort of like a return to or construction of a new normalcy. And looking at Korea, that's a perfect example of that, because the situation there is, again, a legacy of World War II, and really even earlier, but that division there is a legacy of Bloc politics, with Blocs that don't really exist anymore.
Right, or unnecessary, yeah. I mean, you know, it's one of those moments where the ruling classes cannot rule in the old way, and the people are not going to be ruled in the same old ways.
Right.
And that is reflected differently in different parts of the country. Again, and we've talked about this so much, you and I, Don, over the last few years, and that is this crisis of legitimacy. And that's a nice word usually used in bourgeois political science for what Lenin said, a crisis of that could lead to a radical change. That is where the people are not going to be ruled in the ways they have been ruled.
Right.
And they are rejecting the old political parties, the old politicians, the media, and are looking for new forms of political organization, and they're really calling for a new way of governance. And I think inherent in this, in spite of all of the discrediting of the ordinary working person and the poor, inherent in this is a call for a greater democracy, a people's democracy. And Trump manifested that, reflected that in the 2016 election. His victory was a rejection, not just of Hillary Clinton, of course of her, and the corporate Democrats. But it was a rejection of the corporate Republicans. Let's not forget, he defeated 17 Republicans.
That's right.
In the primary. We cannot overlook that. And he defeated all of them soundly. I mean, this is unprecedented.
That's right.
And he literally called for what happened in the most recent Italian election. You know, the Northern League and the Five Star Movement uniting to form a government. He reached out to Bernie Sanders. It was Bernie Sanders who rejected Trump. And I think Sanders' rejection of Trump had a lot to do with Sanders' commitments to the old order of American hegemony, American militarism, and American imperialism abroad while talking about social reforms at home. And if you think about it, Sanders has not yet taken a position either on the military budget or on detente and peaceful coexistence with Russia, North Korea, China, and other countries. So it was Sanders who ran back to the corporate Democrats who failed the people and his voters in 2016. And I think going forward, and I'm going to make a prediction, the Democrats will not take back the House in 2018. Right. And if Trump survives, he will be reelected in 2020. And he will do what he said he would do. If you remember, in 2016, he said that if he has two terms as president, he will turn the Republican Party into a workers' party. Or I would interpret that to mean a party that better reflects the interests of working people, which both the Republicans and Democrats have had abandoned decades ago, they ever were committed to that.
That's right. Agreed. It's tough to reach into your hat and pull out the day that they were representing them. You have to go back to like Teddy, to Franklin Roosevelt. You know, on that question, you know, you've got Sanders, for example, calling Trump a traitor now for meeting with Putin. You know, no agreements were signed with Putin. We have no idea what the conversation behind closed doors was, but we also have no idea what the conversation behind closed doors was between Obama and Putin, Bush and Putin, Clinton and what's his name after last call at the bar?
Yeltsin.
You know, Reagan and or Bush and Gorbachev or whoever earlier. You know, this is Gerald Ford meeting with Brezhnev behind closed doors in Helsinki. This is the way that these things are done, and yet the big concern is this: when you have Sanders on the one hand being heralded by the media and in his own carefully chosen words even by himself as a socialist, on the one hand, without a vigorous critique of American imperialism on the other, I'm wondering exactly what kind of socialism you have where the economy that's going to be democratically controlled and owned by the working class can be fueled by labor and materials stolen from other working people at gunpoint around the world.
Right. That's right. And that's the contradiction of social democracy and has been for 150 years. I mean, let's be real. You would not have had the need for Leninism or Bolshevism had social democracy evolved into a revolutionary position. It retreated from that, especially during World War I, where the social democrats united with their bourgeois governments and went to war with their fellow working classes in countries that were deemed the enemies, you know? So, listen, I mean, you know, when you look at Sanders, he is a spent force. Now, you know, he's trying to make himself look younger by, grabbing onto Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. But her victory, of course, you know, we celebrate, but in a very limited way, because her program, she doesn't have a real program to address the multiple crises and problems of the working class, nor does she have any sense of the world crisis and how to address these problems. I think that a sophisticated politician at this time would do as we have discussed over these many, many months, criticize Trump on the issues he needs to be criticized, and sharply, especially on the economy, on the environment, but then support him on the question of peace and imperial retreat. And I guess the other thing is that all of the most important questions, ironically, are not driven by domestic concerns, but the most important questions are driven by the international situation and how the United States ruling class will manage its retreat as it must do. Trump is just years ahead of most of the ruling class. And a lot of people say, well, he represents one part of the ruling class. Well, maybe that's true. But he is a singular figure in history who, I think, represents more the broad masses who have suffered under the World Trade Organization, under trade agreements like the Trans-Pacific Partnership and NAFTA, who have suffered in multiple ways by these permanent wars in the Middle East, and who have in many ways begun to say they don't want to study war no more, which is another way of saying they don't want to be the instruments of imperial hegemony, that the United States must reposition itself in the world. Now, you know, saying that, a lot of people say, well, that's not what the polling data shows. Well, the polling data is incapable of measuring the nuances and even contradictions among and within the broad masses of people. But when you look at what collective behavior, collective political behavior tends to say about major issues of our time. And I'm not talking about abortion. I'm not even talking about some of these other legal questions. I'm talking about the great issues of our time, war and peace, and the possibility of imperial retreat, which then makes a lot of other things possible for the domestic economy and for the social needs of the masses of working people. And I include among them the working middle class, the professional classes, and so on.
I mean, you can include among some of those questions the life of every species on the planet, because the question of war and peace with Russia and China in this particular age is a question of the survival or non-survival of human species and most others that are susceptible to death by radioactivity.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. You know, so war and peace is the major question of environment.
That's right. It is a major question. It's a major question of the day. We're getting close to time. We got about 3 minutes left. One of the things I wanted to make sure that we cover is essentially the response that comes from people on the left when you say, why are we not organizing that which calls itself the anti-war movement to support Trump's efforts in Helsinki to defend him against impeachment for treason on those points, mm-hmm. and also to try to lead from behind. In other words, to raise more demands and say, not only do Helsinki, but start working on nuclear disarmament and start making peace for real in Syria and Ukraine and blah, blah, blah. When we're not doing that, instead, the reaction is that the U.S. and Russia are equivalent. They are both evil capitalist powers, that Trump is an equivalent to Clinton in essence, and that there is no space because the bad guys have control of the levers of power here no matter what. How do we how do we address that?
Well, first of all, you know, we have to demand a certain amount of political realism. Trump is not the most evil president that the United States has ever had, or certainly in the last 70, 75 years. And that's the way he's being portrayed, as a corrupt oligarch driven by venality and selfishness and racism. You know, in fact, I think that as president on questions of war and peace, he is more advanced than Obama, certainly than Bush, by rejecting the Clinton call for a no-fly zone over Syria. He was rejecting a Libyan solution to the Syrian question. That is very, very important. By not treating Vladimir Putin and the government of Russia as a dictatorship and as an equal evil to himself, as he is, as Putin is defined, he makes a tremendous contribution to the struggle for peace.
That's right.
For meeting with Kim Jong-un, the leader of North Korea, and treating him as an equal, not as a pariah. He makes a profound contribution to the atmosphere of the fight for peace. I mean, these people whose main energy is being devoted to a protest against Trump's alleged military parade. Well, I'm not for the military parade, but I'm not for your demonstration either, because that's all you're going to do is a demonstration, and hopefully somebody will capture you in the mass media.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Can you think of a more intriguing storyline, one that includes an attractive Russian woman, money, guns, politics, power, and yes, spying? Unfortunately for Maria Butina, this is not a storyline, but her life at the moment. Is she the most recent victim of the West phobia towards all things related to Russia? Crosstalking Maria Butina, I'm joined by my guest, Ray McGovern in Washington. He's a former CIA analyst and co-founder of Veterans Intelligence Professionals for Sanity. Also in Washington, we have Joe Loria. He is the editor-in-chief of ConsortiumNews.com and author of How I Lost by Hillary Clinton with Forward by Julian Assange. And in London, we have Alexander Mikiris. He is a writer on legal affairs as well as editor-in-chief of TheDuran.com. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Ray, let me go to you first in the swamp. In Washington, D.C. What do you make of this story here? Because it is the timing is very interesting. She's being charged for not being a registering under the FARA law, which I find quite interesting, is that about half of Washington, D.C. does some kind of influence peddling for foreign countries, and they're not registered as a foreign agent. Is she just being picked out because she's Russian? Go ahead, Ray.
Well, Peter, first, full disclosure, I want you to hear this from me rather than from the FBI. I may be called a co-conspirator very quickly because I have met Maria.
Oh, my God. Oh, wow.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, there may even be a picture of me alongside her. It was at a meeting.
I thought you were glowing. I thought you were glowing. Okay, go ahead. Keep going.
It was at a meeting of the session, an evening lecture of the Committee for the Republic, a very nonpartisan, actually mostly conservative group. And I met her with about 100 other people. And there were a lot of people that had dinner together that evening. So that's number one. Number two, I attended the hearing last Wednesday when she came in her orange suit there and was denied bail on the pretense that she was too dangerous a person, that the FBI did not have it in their capability to prevent her from getting into a Russian embassy car and being spirited out of Dulles Airport to Russia. Number three and last, I have been watching, analyzing, reporting on Russia for 55 years. I was chief of the Soviet Foreign Policy Branch at CIA. I am unabashedly in favor of a better relationship between the United States and Russia. I am also completely appalled at the Russiagate drivel that is coming out from all ends now, including from Amy Goodman just this morning on Democracy Now!, who had, Greg Gordon. Reporting on how the NRA funneled money. The conspiracy is right there. And I have to tell you, I talked to Greg Gordon just two or three months ago personally, and he's completely drunk all the Kool-Aid about Russiagate. It's really ridiculous when Amy Goodman and Rachel Maddow cannot be distinguished one from the other.
Amazing. Joe, let me go to you. She's denied bail because she's a dangerous flight risk here. Okay. I mean, looking at her biography and look at her Instagram, very provocative pictures, folks, okay? Food and her love of guns, okay? And her love of America, which is very, very clear. I mean, is this, we don't have a lot of evidence. I read part of the indictment here. This seems like it's a nice ingredient to the Russia, Russia, Russia mantra. Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, I think it's more than that, Peter. I've read the criminal complaint and the FBI agent's affidavit in the case, and I think it's pretty clear that they're setting this up to be the so-called evidence for collusion. As everyone knows, the last Mueller indictment of the alleged 12 Russian GRU agents did not have anything to do with anyone on the Trump team. This crime that she's being accused of is trying to build better U.S.-Russian relations with informal dialogue dinners. Maybe that was one of the ones Ray was at. They are setting up, she met with U.S. person one, U.S. person two. I suspect that this one and two will be somehow linked to the Trump campaign because she met with a political party one, the complaint says, and that was a party that used to be hostile to Russia in the past. You'd have to think that's the Republicans. So this is all being set up, and all she may have violated, as you pointed out, Peter, at the beginning, is not registering as a foreign agent, as a lobbyist. Now, was she working for the Russian government? Apparently, she was working and had worked in the office of the deputy central bank governor of Russia, and she continued to be in touch with him and may have been an interpreter at some of the meetings that he had when he came to the U.S. That she is being accused of illegal activities, but in that illegal activity, according to the FBI, was trying to have better relations between the U.S. and Russia. That's what this has come to.
Yes, Alexander, I mean, it's already been mentioned here. We have the GOP and we have the NRA, and that's just one little, inch away from Donald Trump. Is this the gambit that's in play here? A 29-year-old Russian woman, a successful entrepreneur, likes guns, wants to bring the Second Amendment to Russia, and she's a conservative in America. She's the linchpin, huh? Go ahead, Alexander.
I think that is exactly what it's all about. If you look at the last indictment that Robert Mueller published, which has been discussed, by the way, by Ray McGovern on Consortium News, the thing that stood out for me about it is that there is actually no collusion allegation involved in it in relation to the hack of the Democratic Party National Committee's computers. So what they're now trying to do, and I think Joe is absolutely right, is they're trying to find some evidence of collusion in some other way. And what they've done is they found a young Russian woman who, as far as I could see, was living her own life. I mean, she had her ideas about guns, views which I don't personally agree with, by the way. But she had ideas about guns. She wanted Russia to adopt something like American gun culture. She is very well known in Russia as a supporter of American ideas about gun control or the lack of it, and has campaigned in Russia for that. She's been involved in Russia with those sort of activities. She had a life in the United States. She's now caught in the middle. She is the person around whom this whole threadbare collusion narrative is now going to be diverted, given that the original collusion narrative has all but collapsed.
Yeah. You know, Ray, what I worry about is that I don't know what kind of legal defense that she has, but she's going to be under an enormous amount of pressure here. She faces a 10-year prison sentence. I worry that under pressure she might sing and then start composing. You get my drift. Go ahead, Ray.
Well, that's the name of the game here, of course. You wrap somebody up and then you say, you know, we could put you away for 10 years, but, you know, if you could just remember about this Russian collusion. If you just remember this, that's Manafort, that's all manner of people that the FBI has wrapped up. I have to say here, I feel really strongly about this because the FBI lies a lot. The FBI falsifies documents. And I can cite simply my good friend Tom Drake. Now, they wanted to put him away for 26 years, right? And they took a document that had been unclassified and they put a secret stamp on it, okay? And that was part of the evidence they used with this court in the state of Maryland. Now, thank God James Bamford had the original, unclassified. So he took it to the judge and he said, look, this is what you're dealing with here in the Department of Justice and the FBI. And the judge threw it out. And he said to those Department of Justice lawyers, he said, look, don't ever darken my doorstep again. I don't want to see you ever in court. You perjured yourselves. Get out of here. Case dismissed. So that's the kind of thing that the FBI and the Department of, as Bill Binney says, just us, what the kind of behavior they exhibit. I want to add one more thing, and that'll be very brief. I have to defend myself not only against the FBI, but against my liberal friends who think that I'm defending Donald Trump. I think Donald Trump is the worst president the United States ever had, okay? The only thing I agree with him, and I would point out that a broken clock is correct twice a day, is that there's no reason in God's world why we can't have a better relationship with Russia, and I stand by that judgment.
Okay, well, Joe, is this what it's really all about? Is this really what it's all about? You know, right before the Helsinki summit, we have the indictment come out after Helsinki, and then everybody's got their hair on fire, even people at Fox News. And then we have this young woman caught in the middle of it. I mean, is this all choreographed in your mind? Go ahead. And I want to be very clear. We need more evidence. I'm asking people to speculate with reason. Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, I do think it's obviously choreographed, especially the timing of the indictment. He was meeting with the Queen in Windsor Castle, the exact moment that Rosenstein, the Deputy Attorney General, made the announcement of these indictments. And it was a couple of days before the World Cup final and, of course, the summit in Helsinki. We also, you could throw into that Julian Assange, who's about to be turned over to British authorities. He's linked, of course, to this case because WikiLeaks is named as Organization One in the indictments as having received the purloined documents. When you look at this FBI's affidavit about Marina Butina, you see that it starts with a long political statement, highly politicized statement, full of the typical Russophobia, saying that Russia is trying to destroy our democratic institutions. This is an influence operation, and she is part of this. It's a low-cost, low-risk operation of Russia to influence the United States. I mean, up against the machine of corporate media, this woman is influencing the United States. This is the kind of thing we see. And another thing that needs to be said about her is that I have heard that she's actually a Navalny supporter, the opposition leader with such small numbers in Russia. And she says in her in the affidavit that Butina was talking to Americans about post-Putin Russia and future Russian governments. She was told to talk about that without undermining the current president of Russia. So that would fit into someone who doesn't really like Putin very much and was not working on his behalf.
Okay, it gets more and more complicated. After a short break, we'll continue our discussion on Maria Butina. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Let's go back to Alexandra in London. You know, Alex, I watched Peter Strzok's testimony, and I'm reminded by what we just heard from Ray. Okay, I'll give you my opinion, I think an informed opinion, because I've had to deal with this ridiculous story for 2 years, like the public here. He was clearly lying and was very, very deceptive, okay? Now, his ex-girlfriend, it looks like she's thrown him under the bus. Couldn't happen to a nicer guy, you know? But it's really about the culture of law enforcement at the highest levels in the United States. Now, I don't know enough a lot about this Maria girl. I learned a lot about her in the last few days here. But she's certainly not a big fish, if I can use that term. And it, like I said, I really worry, you know, once you pressure someone like that, you know, they tend to sing and then they'll compose for you here. I mean, this story is not only a tragic story about destroying still another person's life, but it really is about how law enforcement works, and it seems to be quite politicized and quite weaponized as well. Go ahead, Alexander.
Well, I'm glad you brought up Peter Strzok, because, of course, what we're now hearing, and, of course, these are reports, but they seem to be valid reports, is that there was a text exchange between Strzok and Lisa Page, in which he said that there was no there there. And it seems that Lisa Page has confirmed that there is collusion. And that text was sent 3 days after Robert Mueller was appointed special counsel to investigate collusion. And these are the two people, Strzok, who was at the very heart of the collusion investigation. So that seems to me to point very strongly towards a politicized investigation, which is what Donald Trump and others have been saying it is. And I don't really have any doubt about that. Now, if we go back to Maria Butina, well, I think we've already talked about how the fact that the collusion allegation has collapsed in connection with the central hacking allegation. And it seems that any Russian now,
yep,
who has any contact with people of any importance in the United States, yep, is now at risk of being dragged into this thing. And if I can just go back to two things that were said before. One, I think, by yourself about pressure being put on people to talk and say things. A judge, I think his name was Judge Ellis, actually said that.
Yeah.
He said directly to the FBI and the Justice Department in the Manafort case, you're not really interested in Manafort. You're trying to pressure Manafort so you can get at Trump. And they didn't really deny it. So that is exactly the agenda that's been followed here. It was followed with Michael Flynn also, Donald Trump's former national security advisor.
Yeah, yeah.
And it seems to me there's a real risk that that might happen. And of course, in terms of Butina and the allegations against her, the idea that the NRA, one of the most patriotic organizations in America, could be swung round and brought under the influence of the Kremlin by one 29-year-old Russian woman is so far-fetched, it is complete nonsense.
No,
and
Alex.
Yet that is
Alex,
the nonsense.
No, I'll tell you
that
what
we're being asked to believe.
No, but what's pathetic here? I'll kind of, you know, a sleight of hand here. Yeah. No, it's not outrageous, because remember, liberals used to be very distrustful of the national security state. They're not anymore. Let me go to Ray. You know, Ray, the contrast in the last few news cycles, you have Clapper, Brennan, and Comey. Okay. you know, heralding the virtues of the secure national security state. And then we have this young 29 attractive woman that really just wanted to have better relations. And she liked guns and she was a conservative and thought she'd get she could do better for her cause in the United States. We look at these three people on the top that were running the national security state at one point in time. This is the face, and I think it's very duplicitous. Okay, these people are not to be trusted. And people like that are prosecuting this young woman. Go ahead, Ray.
Well, Peter, the proof is in the pudding. People like Comey and John Brennan are running scared.
Yep, yep.
They know
yep.
that the House Intelligence Committee, that's serious about this investigation, has the goods on them.
Yep.
They can go to jail.
Yep.
As a matter of fact, Devin Nunes, the head of the Intelligence Committee in the House, has said precisely that. If they're guilty, they're going to be put on trial. This is a new phenomenon. That's a new deal here in the United States. Now, getting back to the fable, the drivel about Russiagate, it was very, very clear on Amy Goodman this morning, less than 2 hours ago live, okay? She ended up, after giving Greg Gordon of McClatchy 20 minutes, she ended up saying, now, I have to point out that this is all speculation, right? Well, the speculation was this as follows, okay? Robert Mueller has no Russians, as Alexander pointed out. There are no Russians that we've been able to get. We indicted a whole bunch. Yeah, we can indict a ham sandwich, but here's a Russian. Oh, Maria Putina. We got her now. And she's the only game in town, okay? And we're going to make sure that this works, because if we have a Russian, the word was used, we have the Holy Grail, a person that we can set up and say, aha, see? She was working in this intricate scheme through the NRA and everything else to make sure that Trump beat Hillary Clinton. I have to tell you, I've never seen it sillier season as I have seen it now in Washington.
Yeah, but, you know, let me get a Joe here. But, I mean, Ray's absolutely right. But, I mean, if you watch CNN and MSNBC, they don't listen to anything about facts and decisions that have been some of the congressional committees, some of the documents that they've had to claw out of the Justice Department. They'll say, this is good news for Mueller, or they just don't talk about it. It's really amazing to me. It really is a slow motion coup that's going on here. And now they have a redhead Russian woman, 29 years old. Case closed, done. They've done their job. That's going to be the message, I'm afraid. Go ahead, Joe.
Yeah, it's not only the silly season, it's a dangerous season, because you've got the corporate media who, let's, in one example, takes an indictment, which is only an accusation, it is not evidence, it doesn't have to contain evidence, it's not in itself evidence, as absolutely established fact. They are going on that, and they've convinced a huge part of the American population of this, and I think this is what Robert Mueller's mission is to create Russian guilt in the public consciousness, and once it's settled in, by the aid of a fevered media campaign, his mission is accomplished. They're guilty. And we've reached that point now. No matter what happens, the facts, any kind of analysis of detail is irrelevant. And Maria Butina, if she's going to be railroaded as the linchpin, as you called her, of collusion, then that's what's going to happen. I think we're moving towards the resolution of this entire two-plus-year so-called scandal of Russiagate. And it's either going to be the House Intelligence Committee and the Republicans who can bring down some people inside the FBI, even Mueller himself, as being politically motivated, or they're going to win the other side. Mueller will win, and we're going to see her in jail, Butina, that is, as the colluding person, and then that would be the basis for the impeachment of Donald Trump, because that's what this has all been about. Even Peter Strzok, you talked about in his text, was deciding with his lover, Lisa Page, whether to try to stay on and become an assistant district attorney or to join Mueller's team, and he wanted to join Mueller's team, which he did, because it could lead to the impeachment of Donald Trump.
You know, Alexander, these people, the Brennans and the Clappers and the Comeys, I think they're going to skate through this here, because they have the whole national security state defending them, protecting them, and they have the liberal media giving them cover every step of the way. And anyone that disagrees with them is just Putin's puppet. I mean, that message, it's working. It's not working for smart people, but their political agenda, this is what. But on the other side, This is the elites arguing among themselves. A recent Gallup poll, most Americans could care less about any of this. It didn't even reach the point of meaningfulness, okay? It was way down on the bottom here. This is a war on the top. This is what it's all about. It's not about what the American people think. It's about the power that people want to maintain and get back. Go ahead, Alexander.
Well, I think that's all true. But I think the thing we've always got to remember is that, of course, impeachment is something which is carried out by Congress, which is by definition the elite. So if the elite decides to go down this road, they have the power to do it, because that is what the power that the Constitution gives them. So certainly it's true that the wider population, at least the Republican voting part of the population, may not be very engaged in it, but the elite itself is obsessed with it. But of course, that points to another danger, which is that you have in the United States, and I think this is becoming increasingly clear, a disassociation between what people think and are thinking within the Beltway, within the elite generally, and the concerns that ordinary Americans have. And here I'm going to say something about not just right-wing Americans, I mean left-wing Americans too. Joe's perhaps better able to talk about that than I can, Ray also. The point is that I think what Americans, right and left-wing Americans, are concerned about are jobs, are housing, are student debt, are those sort of issues. Yeah. And I think if this continues for very much longer, more and more people are going to start saying to themselves, the elite in the United States is not working for us. And at that point, we could easily see the whole Trump situation reviving with someone else.
For young Maria here, the system isn't going to work for her either here. Ray, I'm going to give you the last 30 seconds of the program. Go ahead, Ray.
Well, I agree with Alexander. And I would caution that even the smart people are taken in by the 85% of the media that keep drumming Russiagate. And that's really bad. A last word here, as a former intelligence officer, I would ask anyone to take a look at the tradecraft exhibited by Maria Butina. There is no tradecraft. She's a Russian agent? My God, then why does she put everything right out there where everybody and his brother and sister can read it?
And apparently,
this is going to be a funny story.
She communicated with her handler via email. Wow, wasn't that devious? That's all the time we have, gentlemen. Many thanks to my guests in Washington
and in London. Yeah, she said she might be recruited by the
Russians. Thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time, and remember, crosstalk to us.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.